Good evening. You are listening to the Yenna podcast. Joining me this evening on Wednesday, the 15th of May, we have Mark.
Hey.
And Roman.
Kia ora.
And Craig is away this week. There's a man here who sounds a little bit like him, but with a slightly different voice.
So Craig has been replaced by Barry White. Is that what we're hearing?
Oh, yeah. No, it is Craig, but I have a cold at the moment, so my voice isn't quite as bad as it was a couple of nights ago when I joined a meeting to talk about the conference planning, but I still have it. I'm on, I think, by fifth day of having this cold now. I'm getting sick of it. I want it gone. But anyway, so yeah, I've been working from home. There was a bit of a conspiracy going around work because last week we all got our free flu shots, and they said, it was the flu shots that have made us all sick.
I hope they were joking, just to wind you up.
Pretty much. Although I did have a win at work. My desk neighbour, she normally doesn't get flu shots because she didn't like needles. And we had a nurse come to work and give flu shots to people. And then she came back late in the afternoon, showed me her little card and said, I decided to get it after I talked to her about it and said it was a good idea.
Nice. Good work.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
Pretty cool that your employer is bringing in like a nurse to do the shots.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Special. Unique.
Yes. Or bringing in a nurse to infect the company with some nasty... It's a nasty vaccine.
Yeah, I think a lot of larger companies do that. You know, I think economically it makes sense if they can get fewer lost days. When I used to work for ANZ Bank, they'd get a nurse in every year and do the same. My company at the moment offers, I think, 50% off the flu shot, but we've got to organise it ourselves. Still worth doing, definitely.
Yeah. Well, if it stops one or two people from coming down with the flu and being off for 2 or 3 weeks, then it's probably makes... sound business sense. But then last Thursday night I went along to the choir and announced that I'd got my flu vaccine that day, and then one of my choir buddies said, I never get the flu vaccine. I had it 1 year and it was the sickest I've ever been. And
yeah, for some people that's evidence, right? You know, I got sick after doing this. Yeah. Post on ergo propter hoc.
Yeah. Let everyone weep for humanity. When I used to work in a medical laboratory, there were some technicians in the microbiology department who would say the same thing about vaccine, the flu vaccine. And they would let us go, like, I mean, because obviously it was a hospital, so we could leave our work and go get our shots and then come back. That was paid to do that. And people were like, no, I'd get sick. And it's like, you are a I guess you're not a virologist, but I mean, you know, you're getting paid more than I am as a... just a peon laboratory specimen technician, and I'm getting my jabs.
Weep. that's my health update. I'm hoping in a couple of days it'll all be behind me, and I'm gonna keep muting myself tonight because as I talk I start wanting to cough.
Hang on, I think I might have a segue. So Bronwyn and I the other night we had a movie night where we watched bad Chinese movies, and it turns out one of them was so bad and boring we couldn't even watch the whole thing. The second one was bad enough that it was enjoyable, and then we watched bits of a Neil Breen movie. For anybody who likes bad movies, Neil Breen is kind of the cream of the crop, like way cringier than Tommy Wiseau and The Room.
Yeah, like you got to admire Neil Breen for his output. Like Tommy Wiseau puts out The Room, but I guess Tommy Wiseau made enough movie from The Room. Like Tommy Wiseau is the rich man and Neil Breen is like, I don't know, the Michael Moore of it all.
Yeah, he's more of a slow burn. I guess it's taken him a while to get the recognition, whereas you're right. I mean, Wiseau's first movie, you know, it didn't take off straight away, but eventually it became that cult classic that gets shown at midnight in various cinemas, and I guess he's managed to pull in royalties all the time for that.
Yeah. Or Wiseau's just sort of maybe even somehow slightly a better businessman, because he was in L.A., and I guess sort of tapping into some sort of L.A. zeitgeist.
Yeah, it could be, but Breen's movies are so much worse. But yeah, I think we're gonna have to do a second part at some point. There's the sequel to Neil Breen's movie Twisted Pair, which is called Cade, which presumably follows one of the two AI something twins. I couldn't quite work out what was going on, but I think he's part AI, but he's become a humanoid to come to Earth to do something. It's all very strange. But this is where the segue comes in. Speaking of movies, Bronwyn wrote a movie review for the newsletter.
Yeah, I did.
Well, I was going to ask if we just turned into a movie review podcast.
We could. I'm happy to just watch movies and talk about them, but it might get a little bit boring for the listeners after a while.
And for me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. You. I mean, you know, isn't it always a surprise when you come on the podcast having not read the newsletter?
I have read the newsletter.
Ooh, shots fired. Yeah, Craig, I have a, I'm talking about movie reviews, and before we let Bronwyn speak, I have something to bring up with you, which is your movie review that we talked about a while ago of, was it Megan?
Yeah.
That movie you said you quite liked with the AI doll girl thing.
Yeah.
I watched that. That is what, like, it's not peak bad, but it's one of the worst movies I've watched in the last few years. It is horrifically awful.
Well, we obviously have different tastes, and I find movies like that amusing.
I don't think we have different tastes. I have taste, I think, is what it is.
Your taste is for sharks, though.
I do like bad shark movies. I like what I'd like to think are really good movies, and I like really bad movies. Extremes are good for me.
Right, so I'm just looking up. It gets 6.3 out of 10 on IMDb, so better than average. 93% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Megan,
so I think yes, 93%.
Rotten Tomatoes must be broken. Hang on, is that the viewer or the critic rating?
Yes,
they have two
93% on the Tomatometer and 78% audience score.
Jeez,
so you are clearly in the minority, Mark.
Yeah,
I obviously have good popular tastes.
Yes.
You have niche weird tastes.
I am in the discerning minority here. I will accept that.
Okay. While you're online, Craig, pull up Late Night with the Devil, which was the movie that I did my review on.
Okay. Well, hang on. Just before
and
we leave
back.
Megan.
Before
we leave Megan, the critics' consensus is unapologetically silly and all the more entertaining for it. Megan is a rare horror comedy that delivers chuckles as effortlessly as chills.
Okay, so the critics also like bad movies by the sounds of things.
Well,
wow.
Yes.
Okay, Late Night with the Devil is 97% from 202 reviews. So that's the reviewer score, and 81% from the audience. But 97% from reviewers is pretty good, I think.
Yeah, well, so, yeah, slightly better than Megan. 4% better than Megan.
And I can kind of see where that review, like, you know, the difference between what viewers are thinking and reviewers and viewers are thinking. I think certainly from a reviewer point of view, Late Night with the Devil is very much a, it's a bit of a tighter, it's a tighter film. It hits upon a lot of, you know, tropes. And if you, you know, not quite, you don't need to squint to see them, but there are some very clear allusions to other horror films. I think it's also an easy film to recommend to other people. But as a horror film fan myself, I enjoyed it. I absolutely am happy to recommend it to skeptics to watch. But at the same time, it wasn't scary. So if you're looking for a scary film, this is not it. And I know a few reviews have been touting it as, you know, the next Exorcist. No, this is not the next Exorcist. This is not going to be like, you know, the 1970s response to the Exorcist. Maybe in terms of the theme of it being a young girl who is possessed per se, but yeah, I don't think it would take out that crown.
The Exorcist only gets 78% on Rotten Tomatoes.
What?
there's something broken with Rotten Tomatoes here. If these movies are getting much higher scores than The Exorcist, something's gone wrong.
Unless they're pulling out, like, what kind of reviews are they pulling out for The Exorcist? Are they like sort of the retro 1970 reviews where a lot of people probably, A, were very afraid and probably did think this film was quite evil? Or are they more contemporary reviews?
A lot of Christian reviews then that gave it like one star.
I guess they're not getting reviewers to submit reviews online at that time, are they? So perhaps there's a smaller number of reviewers that, and maybe American sensibilities at the time were more conservative, and so they were offended by it. And isn't it really long?
Mm. I mean, you know, And now I saw this film back in early April at the Lumiere Cinema in Christchurch, and that was quite a nice experience to see it in a nice seat, eating my Shay chocolate, which I now know is another cult, or at least led by another guru in Christchurch, which will be an interesting write-up on in the next year or so. But there was a really great, interesting article about the man and the man who runs Shay Chocolate. So if you can find that old article in the Christchurch Post online, give that a
How does
read.
one spell that?
SHE.
Oh, okay.
Is it
Yes,
she or Shay?
oh, okay.
But
All
going
right.
back to talking about the film, I certainly appreciate it again for all the like for there's an aesthetic aspect to this film. I guess what they call retro, but not RETRO, but RETRAUX. So like sort of a fake retro look. It was sufficiently brown in terms of its coloring. You saw little digs at Ed and Lorraine Warren, allusions to Anton LaVey. But I think the one thing that's going to be really, really interesting for skeptics, or will certainly tweak a little people's tweak some people's brains, is going to be the character of Carmichael Haig. So Carmichael Haig is this stage magician turned skeptic. So he is the jerk of the piece. He's what they call in trope in sort of tropes the hate sink. You are not meant to like this guy, but he's kind of a James Randi channeler in a sense. There's so much like his appear not quite his full appearance. He doesn't have the big scraggly beard, but he's his a lot of his activities in the film are similar to James Randi. So he's going around saying, yep, here's the $100,000 check to prove that this is actually a for evidence of the paranormal. He is a stage magician and he's talking about all these experiments that they do to try to prove the paranormal. And people who have who people and because this is a film that was filmed in Australia, the screenwriters are Australian. There have been some allusions to a couple of scenes in this movie that people say are kind of similar to James Randi's appearance on an Australian talk show called the Don Lane Show. I think that's what it was because Don that he was an Australian talk show host and he got pretty heated with James Randi during one of their appearances when James Randi was kind of attacking a psychic or a channeler, a medium, I think it was, might have been Mary Fry, I think. So
Right.
a couple of people who have been messaging, I think it was one of our regular conference attendees had mentioned had pointed this out and I'm like, yeah, that's exactly right. So I think some people are easily picking up on it. But Mark, you had seen the film. What was your thoughts?
Yeah, so I watched it basically on Sunday. So Sunday night late is normally when I prepare the newsletter, and I didn't want to hit any spoilers when proofreading your review, so I had to cram in an hour and a half of movie watching before putting the newsletter together. Horror is generally not my cup of tea. I think for this one, the first half was much more fun than the second half. I think when we finally got to the scary bit, or the more the paranormal bit, as you say, it's not so much a horror, but it's got those paranormal elements with weird things going on. That bit really didn't float my boat. But the first half was really nice, and as you say, the costumes, the set design, the whole 70s feel was done well. I imagine the budget wasn't great. Wasn't huge for this movie. It feels a little bit cheap, but it's still very well put together. And I guess just the nature of it being made on a set in one place, at least most of it is just on a set, kind of allows them to keep the budget low and still produce something good quality.
There's a little bit of controversy because I don't know, did you notice any AI artwork in the film?
No, was there some AI work in there?
Yeah, this was controversial. When the film was originally released in the South by Southwest, like it was screened in South by Southwest, I think either earlier this year or late last year. No, this particular scene wasn't in the film. So now it's out for regular release. And someone noticed one of the title cards when they were doing the, sort of they had those sort of 70 styles and, now word for our sponsors. Welcome back to Night Owls. Well, one of those little 3 second, like 3 or 4, 5 frame scenes is AI. And so one of the
Okay.
skeleton amongst the
And does the skeleton have extra
audience.
finger bones by any chance? Is that how people could tell it was AI?
I'm not sure if they had extra fingers, but definitely like it looked off.
Okay.
So
Something
if
was
you,
odd
yeah.
about it. And yeah,
So, yeah.
interesting.
So, yeah. So, I mean, I don't mind it. I felt like, whatever was in the special effects budget to make the film look as it did, I thought it was all I thought the money was well. I thought the money was well directed to where it should be directed, and a 3 or 4 frame AI image. I understand that, you know, when you're in the industry and you're having your jobs threatened by AI, yeah, that this is pretty a touchy subject. But I don't know how much money was saved or lost by using this particular AI image. But there was somebody on Twitter who was trying to boycott the film. On the basis of this scene.
Get the pitchforks out on Twitter. Yay.
Yeah.
So, yes, I think, like, not my type of horror. I'm more kind of, let's say, Midsommar or Mother was a really good, really creepy movie that worked really well, kind of psychedelic mind-bending in a way. But, yeah, standard horror, really, like, either it's not scary and I don't get it, or it's scary in a way that I just don't enjoy. I don't want to be jump scared too much. I'm not big on torture porn. I don't like, I just feel too sorry for people that are being tortured, and watching it on screen just makes me feel uncomfortable. Not scared, I just kind of feel sorry for the people that are going through this, and there's no enjoyment for me with that. So yeah, I like most horror I don't get. This one wasn't bad like that. It wasn't that exciting. But I think the point that we talked about the other day together that is really interesting to me is that James Randi character and how often this character comes up in movies. And I guess, you know, looking for these connections where you can tell that it's James Randi, one of the simplest ones is just the character has a goatee. so often, you know, they're always male, I guess. I don't think I've seen a proper female version of Randi yet. I don't think Dana Scully really would count.
No, but I guess for me, like, this is the sort of like, oh my, we're going into spoilers. So, you know, Craig, you may want to edit it a bit where you say come back at, you know, this point of time.
So
in the,
I want to object to the characterization of James Randi having a goatee. He never had a goatee. He's got a big bushy white beard.
No, but earlier on in his career, he had the whole pointy thing, didn't he? He had like the tash and the little like devil line down at the bottom, I think.
No, I'm struggling to find an image on Google of him.
I think he's had a goatee.
I would certainly say that given the, you know, that there was sort of a devil worshipping sort of Anton LaVey coded behind the scenes antagonist, or, you know, behind the scenes villain. I think there was sort of couldn't quite tell in terms of the direction of the plot whether Carmichael was sort of more Anton LaVey to James Randi, but I think he was certainly more coded to be James Randi than Anton LaVey.
Yes, it felt like it. And, you know,
There's some red herrings about Carmichael, and you don't know where, you know, there's some things that happen later on in the film. And you're kind of like, oh, is that like, foreshadowing?
I got the feeling that was more about, you know, less that he's a believer, more that he's just not Christian, but he, you know, we can see the writing on the wall when it comes. I think I know the scene you're on about. But yeah, so the other characters that, you know, are similar, like the first one I thought of was, if anybody's seen Nandor Fodor and the Talking Mongoose, bit of a weirdly named movie. It's Simon Pegg. He's a paranormal investigator with a goatee who goes to investigate a talking mongoose. The whole thing looks really suspicious from beginning to end, and he's very skeptical, but it's kind of, it still leaves you wondering, and it's kind of a nice story in that one. I still wouldn't recommend it as a movie. It was a little bit weird, but it kind of leaves you thinking, well, maybe a little bit of mystery and a little bit of intrigue is fun, and just destroying it by, you know, being all rationals, a bit boring at times. So an interesting message there. But can we think of any other movies that have a Randi-like character in? No.
Because every time I try to I was looking at TV Tropes, and even TV Tropes wasn't really useful, because TV Tropes doesn't just do TV, it does film. But even then, that wasn't very good, like, in terms of finding a Randi-like character. And I think Carmichael Haig, that character might be one of the closest that we've gotten to it, as well as in terms of like the other aspects of James Randi, which includes the $100,000 challenge. But I think probably the closest to what we are thinking of is potentially like what TV Tropes called the detective magician. So in particular, within this trope that you'd see in film or media, is a magician who uses his skills to show that, you know, people scamming or these crimes aren't magical, aren't impossible, but have very possible causes and explanations.
Yeah.
So I just asked ChatGPT, what movies have a character similar to James Randi, and it actually listed out an honest liar.
that so is James Randi.
Exactly. And a Penn and Teller show and Happy Days.
Okay, so he was on Happy Days.
And where James Randi has appeared.
Yeah, yes. Okay. So it tried and it failed. The other movie, and actually one of my favorite movies, a friend recommended it to me and said that the main character reminded me of them. I don't think they knew any other skeptics, so I was the skeptic in her life. But Magic in the Moonlight by Woody Allen. And I know we're a bit boo-boo about Woody Allen, but I can't help but think that, you know, his movies are good. And this one in particular, again, it's a magician who debunks, not with a goatee. It's Colin Firth, clean shaven. But the story is really nice because much as in one way he is very dismissive of anything paranormal and is always fairly convinced, except for one point, that the paranormal is just nonsense, I think he comes across as a really good character. There's not that snarkiness that we often see with these other kind of skeptical characters who always seem to be a bit of a downer and a bummer for a movie. But in this one, he is the protagonist. And I think he still, for all his grumpiness, he comes across very well in that movie as, I guess, someone I would like to emulate, someone I would want to be like. Polite in one way, but also just not putting up with any nonsense at the same time.
I elaborated my prompt to ChatGPT. ChatGPT obviously has the powers of listening to future episodes of our show, because I said, what about fictional movies? And one of them it listed was Late Night with the Devil.
Oh, and what were the others it listed?
Well, then it came back again with An Honest Liar and Happy Days.
But I guess, you know,
what is socks.
Then I guess what is that? What does that mean for the public profile of skepticism? You know, was James Randi just such an immense personality and such a, I don't know, a hustler and a grinder at the skeptical craft that, you know, we don't really have potential, like maybe Penn and Teller, but you know, but that they're like, they'd be like a very, very distant second to filling in that space. We probably more likely get, you know, you're more likely to see Chris Angel sort of parodies in media. You wouldn't, you know, David Copperfield at one point, not now. Like, who would be the next, you know, sort of magician skeptic?
Hmm.
Who would capture the imagination?
I don't know. I mean, Derren Brown, if he ever stops playing around with pretending that he uses neuro-linguistic programming and starts being honest about what he's doing, like, he is pretty skeptical sometimes, and he is very good, at least after heavy editing, at being a magician on TV. So yeah, I mean, possibly he'd fill that spot. I don't know.
Cause I think yes. one thing we kind of miss a little bit on, this was something that was pointed out both again in TV Tropes, is that a character like Dana Scully, who is sort of, yes, you know, an obvious skeptic, they become kind of parodies of themselves in these fantastical paranormal shows, because of course this is a show, this is, you know, fiction. So these are fictional worlds where, yes,
the paranormal is real.
Yeah, and so, right. Yeah, they're parodies themselves in the sense that, you know, your skepticism is, you know, unwarranted, or your skepticism is always going to be disproven. So, you know, we don't really have, again, you know, Dana, but she's kind of a mockery in a sense because of how much she holds on to her skepticism in the face of evidence.
Did we jump over number two, the Kawai Pura Pura?
Yes, you did. Or someone did.
I did. Well. I did.
Right. Okay.
I had my segue that I just wanted to do. It's great.
Okay. Well, who's going to tell us about the things like, going on there?
Well, how about you come up with a really good segue there, Craig?
No.
Okay. All right. How about this? One thing that horror movies aren't is kawaii, which is cute in Japanese. Speaking of kawaii, Kawaii Pura Pura. How's that? Did it work?
That is painful, but I'll take it.
I think you confused me, but
yes, right. Kawaii Pura Pura. For listeners who may be able to dig deep into their brains, what was it last year? Was it last year or 2022 when we went and visited the Mormon Church in Hamilton?
We had a nice 2022, little 2022, I think. Was it August, like the year before last?
Mm.
It will have been, yeah.
So we had, so after we saw the Mormon temple, before it was reopened, we had a lovely little road trip up to Auckland. And during that road trip in Auckland, we got to go see the former site of the Centrepoint Commune in the North Shore of Auckland, and pretty much in Albany.
Can we call it Centrepoint Cult? Because that's pretty much what it was, an abusive, horrible cult, not just a, an intentional community commune thing.
We don't want to get sued.
Yeah, we do. We got more money than we need. It's fine. Sue us. It was a cult. It was weird.
But anyways, on the property, on the former Centrepoint property, that was bought several years ago, and it used to hold Well Park therapies in the Well Park school. That's since closed down. There are some people and different businesses that are on site, but everyone's been kind of on notice for the past couple of years because that property's been on sale, and nothing was really happening until this week, when notice came through to all the occupants on that property that they got to go because a mystery buyer has been found, and that mystery buyer wants people gone. So everyone's
when we visited, it wasn't obvious that there were residents. We kind of saw the Well Park buildings. The whole thing looks a little bit shoddy and ragtag, like people have just walked onto the site with a hammer and nails and some wood and kind of hammered together buildings. But from what it looks like in this article, it says there were maybe 70 to 100 people living there, and the houses are anything from established buildings to like just shacks that have been put together.
Well, we only saw probably a very small portion of the property.
Yeah, yeah. Like, so we went to the entrance. We didn't dare going too far because it would be a little bit intrusive. Maybe we should have done. Maybe we should have just got out and gone for a walk around the whole property until someone stopped us. That might have been a good thing to do.
Hmm.
I think people visit the property. I think a lot of former residents visit of Centrepoint visit that property quite frequently. There is still a grove where a lot of them buried their placentas and stillborn babies.
Right.
And miscarried babies. So there is still like a very significant emotional attachment to that property. But now it's been bought and everyone's upset.
When it comes to the residents, it looks like some of them have been there since Centrepoint days, right? The article I think said, or one article I found said there were some residents have been there for four decades, which takes you back to 1984, which is like early Centrepoint days.
Mm-hmm.
So some people were there during Centrepoint's heyday. And are still there. So, you know, I can't help but think the more I read about the site now, the more it feels like that connection has not been broken. There are still deep connections to the Centrepoint adults at the time who were there. And I feel like there just hasn't been enough of a clean slate with that place. Almost needs to be kind of raised to the ground.
But it's going to be interesting because go on, Craig.
So you're not going to announce that the New Zealand Association for Rationalists and Humanists have done a swap for a rationalist house.
So the NZARH are looking at selling Rationalist House, but a swap for that place. I mean, obviously, you know, the rationalists don't believe it's cursed, but it's probably as close to a cursed place as you can get.
Oh, my God. Imagine the upkeep, though.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if, you know, so much of it, kind of, you know, as you said, the buildings have been there for 40 years. What's, you know, how well those buildings have been maintained?
The interesting thing from reading the story, the reason they were selling it was because the owners were sort of cash strapped. Their other businesses were cash strapped, and so they wanted to get out of it. But the Kawai Purapura, if you go to their website, it's listed as the Kawai Purapura Retreat Center, and they are actually hiring out the venue to people. So they must have had some sort of deal with the owners that they were sort of managing it and hiring it out.
Well, it may be, you know, that's the stuff that's probably going to start coming out in the wash, because if they're starting to evict the residents, we don't know if maybe they're still actually, you know, you can have a website, but if you haven't updated the website, if you haven't taken down the website, may find that people are throwing in inquiries and getting told, no, sorry, we can't. But the big, you know, there's a little bit of interest into who has bought it. A couple of rumors from that article sort of indicate that it could be someone from the community, like, you know, it's somebody that people know. And the expectation is that he would sort of keep the spirit of the place. But, you know, if you're picking everybody, how much are you trying to keep the spirit of the place? You know, is it going to be redeveloped?
possibly somebody in the spiritual community, but I can't imagine they're that closely connected if they're evicting all 70 to 100 residents in, I guess, what's the minimum time? I mean, presumably 28 days is, you know, legally the minimum they can give.
News article saying less than a month. So I guess that could be 28 days.
So I was looking at tenancy, like if depending on if you're like a tenant and or if you're a landlord and you need to give notice. You know, if you're not evicting somebody because someone's been physically assaulted, and just say these people have periodic tenancies, which have no fixed end date. If they've sold the property and the purchaser requires the landlord to give them vacant possession under an unconditional sale agreement, it looks like apparently the landlord should have given them 90 days. And it still seems potentially, but it may potentially vary under a couple of, like maybe 63 days under a different set of conditions. It's about 90 to 63 days, 63 to 90 days. But we'll that's only to, under periodic.
We'll have to wait and see if they end up with a court case being run by Sue Gray or maybe Ashley the advocate. Well, I guess she can't run a court case, but she can be there as an advocate for them. See if they end up mounting any kind of legal case to try and get themselves more time on the property.
Or maybe they'll just have an occupation or become squatters.
But apparently, it depends. Maybe if they had all fixed-term leases, if there was only less than 21 days between the end of the fixed-term period, they don't really need to give notice. A landlord doesn't really need to give notice to the end of tenancy.
So if it lined up well, maybe that's all they need to do. But a friend of mine pointed out a really good thing is that, you know, when I looked through their Facebook page to look at the events they were running, and there were events teaching people about honing their intuition and interpreting dreams. And there's a tarot card reader on site as well. And given all of this ability to read the future, he pointed out it seemed a little bit surprising that none of them saw it coming, that they were about to be evicted, that for all their powers, they couldn't see this huge thing in their lives coming their way.
But I wonder if they did. And they're maybe potentially hoping if that you had a buyer who was sympathetic or part of the community that they would be able to maybe go to, you know, change their lease or something.
I can imagine they're probably that, not that they did know because they are able to tell the future, but they did know because, you know, this kind of thing normally doesn't happen in a vacuum. Any potential buyer has probably been shown around the property. There would have been murmurs and rumors, presumably, before this deal was finalized. So, yes, I mean, I imagine the shock is something of a faux shock, maybe, when they're talking to the media. I presume, I can't help but presume that the owners have done their due diligence and talked to a lawyer, and, you know, the 28 days or the month notice that they've given is all they legally need to give. I'd be surprised if they were doing something sketchy.
Mm.
I necessarily wouldn't be surprised if they were doing something sketchy, but, you know, open minds.
They do own a spiritual retreat after all. I mean, they're not quite connected to reality.
So watch this space, Craig. I have to say at least once in this podcast.
Well, the space is relatively close to my place, and I didn't even know it was going on. So
you can watch this space. You could drive in there like once a month with your Tesla and see what's going on.
That could do, yes.
Stick out like a sore thumb next to everybody's 40-year-old cars.
Imagine we could have had that space for a conference. Though now, if it was being sold, probably would have been up in the shit. At this point,
can we one? Yeah, I mean, like, you know, we've done a nunnery, right? And we've done some other weird places for our conference. Could we do the Centerpoint Commune?
I think it'd be a little bit gauche.
I think it'd be a little risky as to whether we would be able to firmly book the place.
Yeah, good point. Imagine if they pulled out last minute, we'd have to have it at your place instead, Craig.
It would really be a skeptic camp because we'd be able to, you know, put people up for accommodation.
Okay, so things have been happening in the skies over the past weekend.
What, UFOs?
Are they being blamed for it?
Probably by someone.
But yes, no, the skies have been lit up with the aurora. Now, is it aurorae? Do we have a single aurorae or do we have aurora? In your researching, did you discover that, Mark?
I think it's just Aurora is a singular, presumably. Aurora Australis is the Southern Lights. I don't know whether it, over multiple nights it would be Aurorae. Is Aurorae even a plural of Aurora? And if it is, would it have to be multiple nights to make it a plural, or would it have to be multiple colors to make it a plural? I don't know.
I, as I've revealed, I was in my sickness when I wrote the item for the newsletter, so I can't say that I went particularly deep. But yeah, so that's been lighting up the skies. It's the result of a coronal mass ejection from the sun. And it's sorry, hang on, let me have a good cough. We can get through this. So there was I just had a coronal mass ejection from my lungs.
No.
Yeah, so there was a coronal mass ejection from the sun. The sun is at its solar maxima, which means that the sunspot activity is at its peak of the 11-year cycle.
The sun is at its angriest.
Yes, the sun's at its angriest. So there's all these solar storms that are going on, and when things get really bad and really angry on the sun, sometimes things collide and it ejects a huge wad of goop and heads towards some planets, and we happen to be in the way. And so that sort of accelerates through, well, no, it probably doesn't accelerate. It zooms through space, not at the speed of light. If there is a solar flare, that is what travels to Earth at nearly the speed of light, because it's basically just a big bright flash. But a coronal mass ejection is actually ejecting some mass, and it's not traveling anywhere near the speed of light.
Electrons, I believe. I've just looked it up to make sure, and NASA says it's electrons. Right. So it's obviously a single, almost massless, or a very low mass charged particle that flows towards the Earth and does funky stuff, right, when it hits the atmosphere.
Yeah, so it interferes with our own magnetic field around the Earth, and that excites electrical discharges in the atmosphere, as I understand, and they interact with various molecules that are in the atmosphere. They ionize those, I believe, and that's where you get the colors appearing. And the colors that appear are depending upon the particular type of molecule that's interacted with. And so there's different molecules at different altitudes. So according to the little infographic that I saw, the pink comes from excited atomic oxygen at high altitudes. The green is excited atomic oxygen at lower altitudes. And the purples and the blues are ionized molecular hydrogen.
Cool. So, yeah. I mean, so presumably what happens, this is like going back 20 years or more to, you know, physics lessons, maybe 30 years by now, but presumably these high energy electrons will end up either ionizing, knocking electrons off one of these atoms or molecules, or possibly just promoting an electron into a higher shell. And often that's when we get light, is once an electron has been promoted into an upper shell, which is an unstable shell, that electron then wants to fall back down again. And when it falls back down again to a lower energy place, it needs to release some energy. And that energy is, because it's a consistent thing from an upper shell to a lower shell, it's always exactly the same quantum leap, to use it, I think, in an actual relevant way. It basically means you get a consistent single color photon that has to be released as the excess energy it needs to get rid of in order to demote the electron back to where it's most comfortable. And so that's why you just get this single color. And it's the same with, I think, when we use like sodium and other materials for street lights, or used to before we went to LEDs, that it's the same thing. You throw electricity through this thing, it promotes an electron. When the electron tries to drop back down into its previous position where it's more comfortable, it's a very consistent frequency of photon it has to release in order to get back down. And so you end up with that single color of yellow for a street light, for example.
Yeah. So, yes, I think that's a good representation of it. But so normally, so we have the Aurora Australis down in the southern hemisphere, and so it's much more easily seen down near the South Pole, or the at least the southern latitudes, because it's closer to the poles, the magnetic poles. Similarly, the northern lights, the Aurora Borealis, are seen much more readily as you get closer to the north magnetic poles. Well, pole, there's only one. And so it was a bit of a rarity for us to be able to see them at such high latitudes. And that was because of the size of the coronal mass ejection that came from the sun. It was quite a big one. And yeah. So we got to see it even as far north as Whangarei, I understand, but certainly here in Auckland. So people went out at like 6:30 on Saturday night and had a look in the sky, and we had this great advantage that the sky was clear, a beautiful clear sky. And so you could look towards the south, even with the light pollution of Auckland, people were seeing some quite spectacular light shows. Unfortunately, I wasn't outside at quite the right time. I kind of missed it a bit, but I did go out, and because I'd seen some activity on social media. And so I went out in the backyard and just pointed my cell phone camera at the sky and set it up for a nighttime long exposure of about 3 seconds and press the button. And then lo and behold, there was this pink image that came back.
Your photos do look awesome. You did a really good job with that. Like, I went out, so this was the night of our movie night, the Saturday night. I went out and had a look, and it was just clouds for us here in Porirua. Mm. Very sad. Totally missed it. But yeah, you did a really good job.
Yeah, well, so on the strength of seeing a bit of colour in the sky from my cell phone camera, I decided, okay, well, I might as well go and take my real mirrorless camera out and my tripod and go and visit a place called Bomb Point, which is a kind of a bit of a dark spot in our suburb. And I went out there and I met a few other photographers, and they'd been sort of taking some photos for a little while, and they had some quite impressive images. So anyway, I sort of set up, and I got a few that had a bit of colour in them, and the one that I put in the newsletter, there's a bit of green at the bottom of the image, and sort of pink a bit further up. Yeah, I'm not sure how much the blue in there is a result of actual the aurora. I mean, I didn't have a control. I haven't been out there and taken a photo there when there is no aurora, so I'm not sure exactly what we're seeing. And perhaps the green down the bottom could actually be the glow from the lights of Auckland City, and I've got the color balance wrong, but who knows? But anyway, yeah. So I was a little disappointed, didn't get any great ones, came back home, and Susan was saying, oh, go and have a look out the back. And we went and had a look out there, and there was the sky. You could actually see this sort of faint tinge of pink with the naked eye. And I put my cell phone up again and took another photo, and it was very bright pink over our neighbor's house. And so I put that image in the newsletter as well, and that was quite impressive. And I took a few photos there. You can actually see the sort of the vertical stripes of where the sort of curtaining is happening from the aurora.
Yeah, and that's another thing I wanted to talk about was, you know, as well as what's going on with the electrons, there's the interaction with the Earth's magnetic field. And this is why it looks like, as you say, curtain or ribbons, is because often it the path of least resistance is following the Earth's magnetic field. And I think this is also why one of the reasons why you see it more at the poles is because that is the path of least resistance. You know, it basically gets pushed around to both sides from the middle, but where the poles are, I think there are places where it's more likely to get in, and so you end up basically with more of a light show as you get closer to the poles, where weird stuff is happening with the magnetic field, and there's kind of an easier path to get into the atmosphere.
So there was a couple of other photos that I put in the newsletter. So at the beginning of 2020, Susan and I, we did a trip up to the northern hemisphere, and we actually did a trip up into Norway and into the Arctic Circle, and to try and glimpse the northern lights. And it was a bit of a disappointment, really, in terms of seeing the northern lights. We didn't really get any great displays, and What you typically see in photos is these beautiful green streaks in the sky. Well, when they were happening and being captured on our camera, when we just looked at them with our eyes, all we could see were these gray streaks. So we felt a bit disappointed that our eyes weren't correctly rendering the colors. So maybe it's just the age of our eyes, who knows. But yeah, I'm still looking forward to someday actually seeing a really impressive display where it's all going off in sort of naked eye and being able to see it properly. And who knows? I mean, maybe we'll get some more this year since we're at the peak of the sunspot cycle. But in reading about this, I had remembered that I'd read previously about the Carrington event. And I'm sure that a lot of people will have heard of the Carrington event. It happened back in 1859. And this is basically absolutely huge coronal mass ejection. So actually much bigger than the one we've had over the past weekend. So big that it produced aurorae or auroras or an aurora that was visible at the equator. There were reports that people could read a newspaper in the middle of the night by the light it was providing. And so this was absolutely huge. And it was so huge that it set telegraph lines on fire. And it and there were telegraph operators who were getting electric shocks from the currents induced by the swirling magnetic fields into the telegraph lines. And so the estimation is that if we had an event of that magnitude today, it would do a huge amount of damage because we're so much more reliant upon our electronics that aren't necessarily shielded to any great extent against an event of that magnitude. And there was a study done about 10 years ago where they estimated that if we had a Carrington level event today, it could cause trillions of dollars worth of damage and possibly put technology that's sort of hard to replace out of action for months or even years on end. And if you have that sort of event, that's potentially sort of a catastrophe that can sort of cause huge social upheaval and ending civilizations.
I guess it's kind of like the Y2K thing where, you know, there's a certain amount we can do to mitigate. We've probably done a lot less to mitigate another Carrington type event, but you just have to suck it and see. You just have to basically go through one and see what happens. And we know Y2K was a damp squib, probably majorly because we put so much effort into it.
Exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, who knows? Like, I don't know whether it's like larger circuits or smaller circuits that are more liable to be damaged by this kind of thing. Like, as mobile phones get smaller and chips are fabbed at a smaller size, does that make them more vulnerable or less vulnerable? But I know, like, even today, like the other day, Transpower said that they were disconnecting some of the parts of the national grid because there are some parts that they know are more susceptible to damage, and they can kind of figure out which bits can be turned off in order to reduce their risk, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, the things I read about were things like high voltage power transformers, which are sort of quite vulnerable and probably very, very hard to replace. So if it fries that sort of infrastructure, it can knock out cities, I guess, power. And then, yeah, then what happens?
Yeah.
All turns to shit. But, and just one more thing. So the Carrington event wasn't even the biggest one of these events that we've seen in history. Apparently, there are events that the last one happened in about 994 AD, that was powerful enough to leave carbon-14 traces in tree rings. So this must have been hugely powerful. They reckon 10 times the magnitude of the Carrington event. They've seen similar sorts of events in sun-like stars in our galaxy that are happening at sort of 100 times the power of the Carrington event. And so it's possibly only a matter of time before we get one that is absolutely stunning, and they reckon maybe once every 3,000 to 6,000 years.
Wow. So I guess the last one being 900 CE was before presumably electricity use, if we don't count the Baghdad battery as a real use of electricity.
It obviously destroyed all the electronics at the time and set us back thousands of years.
Yeah, destroyed the Tartarian Empire and... Oh, yes, these conspiracy theories, they tie in quite nicely, don't they? Oh, and speaking of that, so in my editorial for the newsletter, I put in a couple of things that we'd managed to find around scaremongering. So the first thing I found was an iPhone app that said it would give you 3 days warning of solar events, solar storms. And for only $9.99 a month, you could subscribe to get these advanced warnings so you could save your family from certain death or whatever the hell it was advertising. The app looked horrible. It's just playing on people's fears. And then I noticed in my Facebook feed that one of my friends, in inverted commas, from the Eastern Lightning Church, she posted a post that said, "The strongest solar storm hits NZ now. Please be safe and get close to God. Then we can gain God's protection." So just using the solar storm in order to get more adherence to the church felt a little bit cheeky. And then Dan Ryan, he keeps an eye out on the local New Plymouth Facebook groups. And on one of those, he found a post with a description of the aurora. And then afterwards, someone had written, "This isn't pretty. This is a serious wake-up call for the people to sit up and take an interest in what's going on. This is demonic tomfuckery with our weather and earthquake control. Wake up time, not time to stand there like a moron and go, ooh, isn't that beautiful? It's a warning of things to come that won't be so pretty." So there are definitely people out there that really don't get science and are just trying to scare everybody else. Sad, really. Disappointing. Yeah.
So if we did have another one of these events, how would it affect our ability to produce oil or to refine oil?
Oh, I see your segue. This is my article. I'm on. It wouldn't, because we don't have a refinery anymore. So it would make no difference to New Zealand's ability to refine oil, because we are in the process of decommissioning Marsden Point, which used to be our only refinery. And this was an interesting one to watch from a couple of years ago, was it 3 years ago? When were the Parliament protests? Was that 2021? Is it that long ago now?
Yeah, that was kind of like our first podcast episodes were about the Parliament protests.
Okay. So when the Parliament protest was mopped up by the police, 2021, we think, but Craig's going to look it up.
I am, because I don't think it was that early.
Yeah, go on then. I'll keep talking while you look it up. I know it can take a while. So after the protest, when the police moved everybody,
2022.
Oh, God damn it. Okay. It was 2022. So police cleared up, told everybody they couldn't stay anymore. And everybody dutifully left quietly without burning down a playground or throwing bricks at people. It was all fine. Some of them popped in their cars and they drove straight up to Marsden Point, which is in Northland. It's, you know, somewhere a few hours north of Auckland. And they went up there to protest at the time the closure of the Marsden Point refinery. Now, because of COVID and other things, the company that owned Marsden Point Refinery, who were called NZ Refining, they've since changed their name to Channel Infrastructure, but they decided that it was no longer cost effective to run the refinery, and they decided they were going to close it down and they were going to convert the refinery, because not only is it able to refine, but it's also a major port because it has to bring in all the oil. So the port facilities are still there. The storage facilities are still there. They were like, well, why don't we just then ship in refined oil products, petroleum products, and then we can ship those. I think it's something like 70% of oil products were coming in there. I think at the moment they're down to 40% because there are other ports around the country that also receive petroleum products. But it serves the Auckland down to Hamilton region. So like top half of the North Island is served from Marsden Point. So they're still going to be able to service a lot of the country with their petrol, diesel requirements, etc. It's just now going to come in refined. So it's not going to be crude oil that comes in. It's going to be refined oil. Now, looking into this and what the protesters were doing, the protesters were arguing that we need energy independence. We need to be able to process oil locally, because everything's going to go wrong as far as conspiracy theorists are concerned. Eventually, the world is going to break. We're all going to go back to being tribal, and we need to be totally independent. So when we get cut off from the rest of the world because they've all nuked each other or a disease has killed them all, we need to be able to cope as a country by ourselves. And they figure that we've got oil fields, we've got a refinery, we should be fine. If we're getting rid of the refinery and we're trusting refineries elsewhere in the world, suddenly we've got a problem and we're not energy independent. We're now much more reliant on other countries. And there is a grain of truth to this. There is a concern about not having a refinery, but it's more to do with the stock levels that we have. Apparently, due to some kind of international agreement, we have a requirement, and any country that signs up to this agreement has a requirement to hold 90 days worth of fuel reserves. Weirdly, that doesn't have to be in the country. It doesn't have to be sitting in tanks. Those reserves can be purchased from overseas and ready to be delivered or on oil tankers and on their way. But every country is meant to have 90 days. We're one of the few countries, I think, where our industry doesn't manage that. And so our government basically pays whatever days our oil industry has lined up. Let's say they have 45, 50, 60 days. The government pays to reserve enough oil to make sure that we meet our 90-day requirement. And losing the refinery means that it does make it harder. We are going to have less of a reserve. And so it's going to cost a little bit more to reserve that extra. It's going to mean we aren't quite as resilient. But the protesters who are up there are talking more about how we need this because we need to be independent. We don't want to rely on anybody else, that Russia and Iran can upset everything. They can block all the oil deliveries, and we need to be ready to go at a moment's notice if that's the case. So they went up there to protest. They hang around with placards. People like Brad Flutie went up there. I think he's persona non grata with the protesters now, because some of these more celebrity conspiracy theorists, they always jump on these bandwagons just to promote themselves. And I think the real hardcore protesters tend to spot this. So there are some of the names that were there in the early days you won't see at the protest anymore. But the people that have stuck it out are people like Carl Barkley, who really is the big name in this. And this came up in Skeptics in the Pub the other week, because James, who we've had on the podcast before, he'd noticed and taken a picture of Carl Barkley's van. And Carl Barkley's van it's got a big protest sign on the side. He wears a T-shirt about Operation Good Oil, which is the protesters' attempt to try and get the refinery back up and running. But the reason he wasn't at Marsden or wasn't going around the country trying to get everybody to back him, the reason he was in Wellington is because there was the annual shareholders meeting of Channel Infrastructure. And the organization, it's called CAFES, which is, I can't remember what they're called, Collective Action for Energy Stability. So this is one of the several groups that the protesters have created. They had come out with a plan called Operation Good Oil. And this was the idea that they were going to, I think originally they wanted to stop the decommissioning of the refinery. In the end, because the refinery is being decommissioned, they now have a more ambitious plan to recommission the refinery. They're going to put everything back as it was at God knows how many billion dollars. These things are not cheap, but it's in the billions. But they reckon that they can rebuild it for billions of dollars and still turn a profit, even though without having to rebuild it, it wasn't turning a profit and they were having financial issues.
So this was is there what nothing, the protesters...
Sorry, go
so
on.
Just, was there anything... So there was nothing in the report about how they intend this to be funded, like you say, no defunding, you know, the vaccination programs or anything.
Yeah, so the Operation Good Oil report that they had, which they presented at the AGM as one of their three resolutions, it didn't go into really much detail about how. The main thing they had was, we think there's a lot more money than you say there is, because we think that you're cooking the books and that you're lying to everyone. And that's basically as far as they got. The language in the report is hilarious. The whole thing, the wording they use is just so bogan, down-to-earth Kiwi. It's beautiful to think that this was like given to shareholders and that the board actually had to read this and try and take it seriously. But so that they had these three resolutions. One was, we want you to accept Operation Good Oil. And some of the recommendations were to start a review for $100,000 to look into the recommissioning. And then they had two other resolutions, which were that this protester, Carl Barkley, and another protester called Daniel, they were putting them forward to be elected to the board. And honestly, reading the descriptions that these two guys had of their capabilities, I think the board were very polite in the shareholders pack when they basically said, we do not think that the capabilities of these people are aligned with being a board member. They could have been a lot ruder and said, what the are these people doing thinking that they can do this job? Because really, you know, one of them's a fitter and the other one installs open source software. This is not the kind of skills you need to be on a board of a major oil company in New Zealand. That's not how it works. So unsurprisingly, they didn't get enough votes for any of these resolutions. The Operation Good Oil got just over 1% of the vote at the AGM. The two nominees they had got about 0.9%, just under 1% of the vote. For me, that's still a big amount. I mean, this is, you know, this is, I think from what I could tell from at least what the protest was saying afterwards, they reckon 60% of eligible votes were cast for the votes that were going on that day. So that's over 50% of, you know, voting stock was used. And of that, getting 1% means that basically 0.6% of shareholders did agree with the protesters on these points. And it might seem like, wow, they did a good job convincing shareholders. But what it looks like is basically the guys ran a campaign for months before the AGM to try and get people who were sympathetic with them to go and buy shares on Sharesies. And looking into it and reading through the information that Channel Infrastructure gave before the AGM, it looks like Carl Barkley himself was bought, I think it was 1,010 shares. I'm not sure how many other shares they've got, but they've obviously done okay. If they got 1% of the vote, they I think they did a really good grassroots job of getting people to buy shares. The issue they had, and as we see, you know, Liz Gunn with the election and things like this, they tend to believe their own hype. And the hype that they went for this was the idea that there are some companies, so some of the oil companies, the petrol companies, they own shares in Channel Infrastructure. And then there are private individuals who own shares as well. And they'd managed to figure out that the private individuals who own shares were just over 50%. And so they were like, well, look, you know, we've got over 50% of the vote because over 50% of the vote is not the oil companies. This was a huge assumption, the idea that everybody that's not an oil company is going to agree with their crazy conspiracy theories. And it didn't pan out. What they did manage was to convince 0.5% or a little bit more of the shares to be bought by their followers, which is still good. I don't think the skeptics could ever convince our members to go and buy 0.5% of shares in a large New Zealand company.
Yeah. So I'm just having a look on Sharesies and having a look at the graph of the share price. And so back, I'm looking back over a 5-year period. So when did this all go down?
So this AGM was about a week and a half ago.
Okay. So, yeah. So if I look back over a month, the share price peaked. Yeah, it must have been about a week.
I think 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. It peaked on the 3rd of May at $1.66. It's now sort of fallen down to $1.53. So it's been up and down over the past 5 years, but over the past year has sort of steadily increased a bit. And it makes me think that maybe the closing of Marsden Point meant that the market went down, and then there was all these crazy people come along and want to put money into the market. And so the people who had lost money on their shares thought, oh, well, I might as well get out now. And here's some crazy fools who are willing to pay over the odds for the shares.
You think we might have had our own little GameStop going on in New Zealand for a while with this? So the report, I'm just going to bring up some of the gems in the report. So page two had a quote from Jesus Christ: nothing is hidden that will not be made known. And from what I could tell, this was their allusion to the financial mismanagement and their massive claims of embezzlement and spending money on the wrong things and hiding assets and devaluing assets and everything else that they said in the report.
Yeah, Mark, was it really a quote from Jesus Christ, or was it just somebody who was reporting what he was supposed to have said?
Oh, that's a really good point. Or was it Mark Twain? I mean, maybe. So the next thing we had was section two, was titled Creative Accounting, Shifty Deals and Woolly Hat Pulls for Shareholders. And in that section, they talked about Nostradamus in the stats department. So they're talking about how they figured that the company was not very good at fortune telling and figuring out what was coming up. They had some COVID denial in it. There was a section that said, nobody needs reminding of the events of 2020 and 2021, in which it was alleged that a new and deadly virus was on the loose that would kill vast amounts of people if drastic measure were not taken. Their typo, not mine. Then it talked about unicorn farts. Started talking about accounting magic, which was their accusations of financial mismanagement. Talked about a TUI ad. They said something and then they wanted to say, yeah, right. So they just said TUI ad. Bunch of typos. A section titled Killing the Goose That Lays the Golden Eggs, which said, could this bizarre move to make the refinery look as if it was a total lemon be an attempt to save egg on the face that would result from having to face the shareholders at the next AGM while holding a green balance sheet? So I don't think they outright ever accused the board of doing anything wrong, but the insinuation was so thick and heavy right the way through it. It was quite painful to read. So, yeah, they're like another section three was titled Incredible Claims by the Prophets of Doomed Profits. They were obviously trying to be clever by this point with their titles. They talked about Russia and Iran. They talked about how electric cars are never going to be a good thing. They're environmentally awful and they're a waste of money. And then the last section, section six, was titled Rouge Shareholders and Rebel Directors Nominated. I think that's meant to be Rogue Shareholders, which presumably is talking about themselves as the
it's an easy typo to make.
It is a very easy typo to make. And yeah, I had to reproduce that whole section basically in the newsletter, because again, it was heavy on suggestions, but suggestions of collusion between business and government. And then at the very end, in all caps, it had written, who is the head and who is the tail? And I think this is, you know, the tail wagging the dog. Maybe the company is basically influencing government to make decisions in their favor. So yeah, the thing was fascinating that, like, having read the craziness of the protesters and their idea and their report, to then go to the shareholder pack and read what the board was doing was a breath of fresh air. It was professional, while also, you know, they basically, the normal stuff that was coming up, like they had another resolution to elect a board member and the board recommended this. But when you got to the three resolutions from the protesters, in bold letters, it's like the board recommends shareholders vote against this resolution. And then they gave a good explanation why. For each one, they'd give polite but firm paragraphs explaining why these three resolutions weren't good. And then already, as we see with these groups a lot, they're rewriting. So as I said beforehand, they were talking about how they had over 50% of the vote because over 50% of shareholders were not large corporations. And since then, I've seen written, I think, by Carl on Facebook. He said, from the strategy perspective, this was an opening salvo. Those of us who work in the engine room always knew this, and we expected 5% or less of the vote, so it's not a surprise to us. They were not talking about that beforehand, but suddenly they were totally aware of the fact that they'd never get the 50%. But the end of my article, the real kicker, and the bit that I found out from James at Skeptics in the Pub, and I looked into more and probably learned more than I ever need to know about oil refining, is that the oil that we get from our oil fields could never be processed by the refinery that we had at Marsden. It turns out that there are different grades of crude oil, both for heaviness, and the heavier it is, the longer the carbon chains in there, and its sweetness or sourness. So the sweeter it is, the lower the sulfur content, and the more sour, the higher the sulfur content. Now, our oil fields, it turns out, make really good oil. Taranaki's not so good, but the rest of them, they produce light, which is easier to crack and turn into useful stuff, and sweet oil, so less sulfur content, less sulfur that you have to deal with as a byproduct. So basically, we make the best oil to process, really awesome oil, and so we send that to Australia because Australia has a refinery that can deal with that. Then we ended up, until Marsden Point closed as a refinery, ended up importing oil from Russia and mainly the UAE and a few other places. And that oil was a medium sour. Yeah, a medium sour, I think. So the sour was, it has a lot of sulfur and it was medium heavy, which meant longer chains, harder to crack. So I think we bought the cheaper oil. And we obviously invested more in our refinery in order to be able to crack that and turn it into useful products like petroleum and diesel and whatever else we make, bitumen, I think, and things like that. But as it stood, you could never just take our local oil if the world goes wrong and we end up being orphaned. You could never take our oil and just shove it through Marsden. The process of converting it, it was hard to find out how much it's going to cost, but I found suggestions that it would have been at least in the hundreds of millions of dollars and that it would have taken years to do. And presumably it would need international expertise and international manufactured parts. I don't think domestically we would ever be able to convert the refinery to process our own oil. So if things suddenly went wrong with the world, we would have been stuck with a refinery that couldn't do it anyway. So their idea that, you know, we need to keep this so we can process our own oil seemed totally naive, basically. But I don't think the protesters are going to give up. As I said, you know, for them, it's an opening salvo. That's what they said on Facebook the other day. This is just the start of what they're planning. They're just going to be up, as far as I can tell, they're just going to be up there at Marsden, outside the fence, watching helplessly as the whole thing gets pulled to pieces. You know, they're going to watch it be taken apart and shipped away.
I don't know how, whether that's actually going to happen now, because apparently Shane Jones, who's a New Zealand First politician, he tweeted out today that the wokeness and naivety closed Marsden Point, our common sense will restore resilience. So he's implying, he stood up in Parliament and talked about how Marsden Point was closed because of wokeism and naivety, and that they're going to restore resilience in New Zealand by not closing Marsden Point.
Marsden Point was closed because the business that ran it saw that it would have been more profitable and less of a liability for them in order to ship in refined products. And the government didn't step in and say, well, if that's the case, how about we throw a few hundred million dollars at you to keep it running because we need it? The government didn't do that. Nothing to do with wokeness. It's to do with business sense and a lack of government interest in saving it. Because I guess the I read a government report that said this is a risk, closing it, but it's not a huge risk. There are some issues, but there are ways to mitigate them. It's not the end of the world. But yes, NZ First, they were saying before the election, like I put in my article a thing from NZ First, New Zealand First will reopen Marsden Point. So that was their thing. If they get into power, and I guess maybe that was if they got into power alone, they would definitely do it. As it is, they're obviously only a part of power. Maybe they don't have quite so much clout, but I think they're a little bit late. I think they're 2 years too late in order to make this a cost-effective thing to do.
Yeah. Of course, in the minds of the conspiracy theorists, climate change is a woke issue, and so they see that processing oil is a thing that woke people are against because it consumes fossil fuels, and
I think that's part of it. And I think the electric car hatred is another part of that. It's like, oh, the woke environmental people think that electric cars are good and oil's bad. Therefore, we need to be the opposite of that. But weirdly, like, a lot of the argument for us continuing to import oil and keep Marsden Point running in the Operation Good Oil document, there was a section on it that basically argued we need more oil tankers of refined products to come in than we would need to bring in crude oil. And because of this, those tankers are going to burn more fuel to get here. And so we're producing more CO2 if we're importing the refined products. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, you're right, a bunch of them are climate deniers. But on the other hand, their argument to keep it open in large part was based on the fact that it's more environmentally friendly for us to import the raw products, which I'm not sure how well that works out as an argument. I presume it's a drop in the ocean compared to all the other pollution that's going on with the product that you make.
Yes, exactly. You need to consider the whole energy life cycle to see where that actually worked out.
But one other thing that I found was interesting, and I finished my article with, was that I engaged with the best foot forward. I engaged with the arguments that the leaders of this group were making. But in doing this, in reading what was being said, I spent a good amount of time reading through their Facebook groups and reading what your average member of these groups is saying. And I was surprised that I didn't find any anti-Jewish sentiment, but I did find climate change skepticism, mentions of QAnon, talk about how immigration is a problem that needs to be fixed, complaining about aerial 1080 poison drops, about how they should be able to manifest results by just hoping positively about it, and talk about how they could use the power of prayer in order to make a difference at Marsden Point. I mean, you know, the average person has a very different view to the people at the top, and their thoughts a lot of the time are a lot less nuanced and a lot more crazy than the few people that I've been talking about earlier. So, yeah, I didn't even want to engage with their arguments because they're just so weird and wonderful.
So I hear that there is a Global Skeptics in the Pub coming up. Who's going to talk about that?
Be. Yeah, I can talk about this one because I'm talking at the moment to the guy that's running it. He's come to us and asked if we can help kick off the event. So it's starting at GMT plus 12, which would be us. So New Zealand is starting it on the 19th of July. So that's Friday the 19th, which normally would be our Skeptics in Cyberspace event. So it's really good that it aligns with that. And at 7 p.m., we're going to connect to a Zoom meeting that these guys, I think it's the Bay Area Skeptics maybe, in the States have organized. And the idea is that it's a rolling meeting, that one Zoom meeting we'll connect to at 7 o'clock and then 9 p.m. our time, which is East Coast of Australia, 7 p.m., the Australians will come on board. And then as more people come on board, the older people will kind of gradually leave. And it looks like a bit of a fun event. It'll be interesting to see how it goes. And one of the interesting things is a question of, are there any blank spots? Are there any places where there are, you know, a group of time zones that don't have organized skeptical groups? Is the meeting going to go quiet for a while? I don't know. But what I'm interested in doing is, one, staying on. So we will be part of this event, and we'll switch out our normal Skeptics in Cyberspace meeting on Meetup for this. I'm interested in staying on a little bit later than 9 o'clock and saying hello to the Australian skeptics. But I'm wondering whether, if maybe as a group, we should organize a Saturday evening meeting as well, and we could possibly join the tail end of this and maybe say hello to the Hawaiian skeptics kind of early evening time on Saturday evening. I think that might be nice.
Assuming there are Hawaiian skeptics.
I think
and potentially avoiding the German skeptics and the Austrian skeptics.
Why would you say that?
Yeah, there are reasons why we might want to do that. But yeah, so it should be a good event. We will let people know nearer the time. But if you want to earmark that as something you'd like to join, that would be the 19th of July. And as I said, well, the three active meetup groups for Skeptics in the Pub, we'll advertise it in all three of those soon. So you'll have more details and a link to the Zoom event.
And other events happening?
Absolutely. This Friday, which would be the 17th of May at 6 p.m. at the Intercontinental Hotel, we'll have our next bi-weekly Wellington Skeptics in the Pub event. Always a good time. We're getting a good crew. We've had some new people show up. Hello, new people. So for people who don't know, who have never listened to this podcast before, the hotel is located on 2 Gray Street, but do not go into the 2 Gray Street restaurant. We are meeting in the lounge inside the main hotel.
Deja vu, I swear I've heard this before.
And somehow it's been helpful. And then, Mark, what's happening the following Thursday?
So the following Thursday, which is the 23rd of May, is Skeptical Activism. So if you'd like to come along to that in Wellington at the Fork and Brewer from about 6 p.m., you can come and meet me and Dan and probably Robin and anybody else that decides to turn up and come and make a complaint. First complaint gets a beer. And honestly, because we're there every 2 weeks and they've got this loyalty system that we pay for the beers from, apparently I have $350 credit on my account at the moment. So I really need more people to come and make complaints so I can spend this money that we have on my loyalty card. Please come and make a complaint. I've got more money than I know what to do with.
Well, hopefully that, you know, that's a convincing beg. Now, on the next day, on Friday, May 24th at 6 p.m., we have our monthly Skeptics in Cyberspace. So I think we have everything up to date for Meetup and Facebook. So just keep an eye on those two platforms and just you'll be able to get the Zoom link that way. Craig, when is the next Skeptics in the Pub in Auckland?
It'll be on the 4th of June, Tuesday the 4th of June, at the Dice and Pork. We had a good turnout last week, including somebody came along who'd been meaning to come to one for a few months, and he arrived, and I thought, oh, you look familiar. I said to him, oh, have you been to Skeptics in the Pub before? He said, no, this is my first time. I said, well, you look very, very familiar. It turns out that he and I worked together when I first moved to Auckland in 1997.
Wow.
So 27 years ago.
Mm-hmm. 27.
So, hi, Steve.
Yeah, 27. And then on June 13th, which is a Thursday at Umbrello's Kitchen and Bar in Dunedin, will be Dunedin Skeptics in the Pub. And then, of course, fast forward through to November. Get ready. We are going to be announcing the date that we will start selling the tickets soon. We pretty much almost have a full roster of speakers for the joint conference of the NZ Skeptics and the New Zealand Association of Rationalists and Humanists. That will be held at the Fickling Convention Center. The main conference will be at the Fickling Convention Center on November 16th and 17th, but we always have a social event on the Friday, which will be November 15th.
Do you think people might get confused between their Zs and their Zs?
I don't know.
Yeah, I swear we are the NZ Skeptics and not the NZ Skeptics, but I can double check our constitution just to make sure.
Well, if you wanted someone to say Zed, then maybe not pick me.
Say it sometimes. You say it sometimes.
Sometimes.
She likes to mix it up a bit. Just keep us on our toes.
Yeah.
I'm not bilingual, but multicultural.
All right. Well, you have been listening to the Year Now podcast, brought to you by the NZ Skeptics.
NZ Skeptics. I'm going to start saying it as well. Let's just all do that, shall we? Confuse everyone.
If you'd like to give us some feedback, you can send us an email to podcast@skeptics.nz. And we will see you all next time. Bye.
See ya.
See you later.